No, I do not. I believe that it is not absolutely necessary to have the.
Well, of course, I agree with that. At the same time, that there's the training in literacy, the training of technical personnel, administrators, agricultural specialists, and so on, must go on at the same time, and of course, is doing so. This is necessary not only to replace the Dutch who go away, but to take care of new problems of technological change.
Seems to me that there is a real sense in which literacy is important for economic development, in the sense that if economic development requires that you disseminate improved agricultural techniques to demonstrate, to show how improved methods can benefit the county, the peasant, if you are to train engineers and geologists and doctors and lawyers, certainly you have to furnish a basis of literacy so that these people can acquire the new techniques.
Of course, I would say that there's a somewhat broader purpose and function of literacy. If only 1 in 5 or 1 in 7 people among in a country are literate, perhaps it's more difficult to build the sort of political philosophy and political state which is needed for a modern state. It is my understanding, though, that a certain number of Indonesians are now going to India and other countries for training in one kind of technology or another kind, with the hope that more Indonesians may be trained to take jobs in their home country sometime later. Is that correct, Mr. Ambassador?
That's correct, Mr. Talbot. I do hope that also our youngsters will come to this country to have the technical training.
There is another problem here in this matter of technical training. I think we have to consider that in a very broad sense to include the social sciences as well as engineering or agriculture or medicine. There are great changes coming into Indonesia now in family life, in village organization, in the old systems of maintaining law and order. These are inevitable with new technical changes.
What sort of changes do you mean, Embry?
For example, the old system of maintaining law and order, or maintaining the old systems of belief in the village, which may be undermined by a changed organization of agriculture or by the development of factory labor, things of that kind, where the old authority of the local men of prestige may be broken down in the face, or may be weakened in the face of the new knowledge of young technologists who get new prestige.
This is, of course, a trend that has been going on for many years before the war as well as now. I think you're perfectly right in the sense that this trend will be intensified and accelerated as the village society is receives the impact of a market economy and of economic development and change technology.
Well, Embry and Wolf, you've both been speaking about these changes. Does that indicate that the ordinary Indonesian would like to be happier, like to have a more rounded life than he had under his old traditional system? Embry?
Well, you've raised a very acute problem there. I don't think anyone beside a philosopher could answer you. It brings up another point, which is that there is this matter of retaining some of the old cultural values at the same time that new technologies are taken on. And unless, well, there is, as a matter of fact, a very rich culture and a rich history in Indonesia on which to build. But when people get going on national school systems, they have a great way of wanting to standardize everybody. That can be a danger.
On that point, Mr. Ambassador, I have the impression from my visits to Indonesia that the Chinese community in Indonesia still retains a great separateness, having its own schools, having a particular place in economic life, and so on. One of the things that struck me was that the integration of Indonesian national life with the Chinese group would be a very great difficulty. Is that correct?
Well, I think it was a great difficulty under the colonial regime. But I think that this problem is not so acute anymore now, since we recognize the Chinese population in Indonesia as being Indonesian citizens. And there are signs that this exclusiveness of the Chinese population will not continue.
Of course, it's perfectly true, I'm sure, that Indonesia has had a broad cultural heritage starting with the people who were there, with the Hindus who came in, then the Muslims, with the Chinese who came, and I suppose you do have the basis for a fairly broad educational scheme and development.
Of course, an American is in no real position to tell other people how to work out their minority problems, but we have had enough experience to know that they are difficult and require a great deal of both human and intellectual attention.
The problems of Indonesia, obviously, are varied and many. Now Indonesia, as a member of the United Nations, comes face to face with the need to make its stand on relations with the rest of the world. I know that all through the nationalist period, the main concern of the Indonesians has been their relations with the Dutch. Independence has now come. I have a feeling that that does not mean, from the Indonesian point of view, that relations with the Dutch are yet entirely smooth.
Well, first of all, I should like to mention, to refer to your statement that we are in a union with the Netherlands. But this union is a special union. I mean, this is not an entity as a commonwealth. But this is a so-called free association between two sovereign states. And we are in a friendly relation with the Dutch now, but we have still one issue, and that is the problem or the dispute on West New Guinea. The Dutch claim that West New Guinea must remain under Dutch rule. And we Indonesians claim that, that historically and politically, West New Guinea belongs to Indonesia.
What about the ethnological case for Indonesia's claim on West New Guinea?
Well, of course, the people of New Guinea are quite different, racially speaking, from the people of the rest of Indonesia. That in itself, of course, isn't the final point. After all, the people of Papua are quite different ethnically from the Australians.
This, however, is a struggle which goes on between the Netherlands and Indonesia, and which, by agreement, should be resolved by the end of the year.
Yes, right.
There is no clear indication yet how that will be resolved.
No, not yet.
I see. Indonesia also has, of course, a great many neighbors within Southeast Asia who are in similar position of having quite recently come out of colonial status into independence. I know that Indonesia has diplomatic relations with a number of these, including the new government of Red China. I wonder if you'd be prepared to state the Indonesian view toward Red China.
Well, we recognize Mao Zedong China. And we are going to exchange diplomatic missions. And we recognize China because we think that the Mao Zedong government represents the Chinese people.
Does that indicate that the Chinese government, to you, will now become that government which ought to be a member of the United Nations as you are, or is that an unfair question to you, sir?
Well, personally, I do believe that Mao Zedong government, so-called Red China, must be a member of the United Nations.
This hits close to your statement about the Indonesian concept of foreign policy as a neutral position in foreign policy.
That's right. The Indonesian neutrality is not an extension. It is an independent policy determined by the internal situation of our country.
Neutrality is something that's a little hard for some Americans to understand when they're in a period of such very, very great difficulties in the world. You believe it can be held, it can be kept, do you?
I think so.
Wolf? What are your responses now to the whole problem of Indonesia and America's relations to Indonesia?
I think the basic fact in America's relations and interest and concern with Indonesia is the crucial role that it occupies in Southeast Asia as the largest, most dynamic, and potentially the economically the strongest country in the whole area of Southeast Asia. For these reasons, the United States, I think, is very much interested in strengthening the foundations of the independent national government in Indonesia and of building up strong cooperative relations with Indonesia.
Just one additional point here. When I was in Indonesia last, I noticed that Americans had a habit of adopting colonial Dutch ways of life, insisting on driving around in cars with chauffeurs, and in other ways, living in a manner quite different from the Indonesian. We must learn a new human relationship with the Asians.
Mr. Ambassador.
May I remind you of the unanimous decision of the United Nations General Assembly on September 28th to admit the Republic of Indonesia as its 60th member. Our membership will be a great asset for us in carrying out our political ideas and in getting assistance and cooperation in the solution of our economic and social problems. Our people feel that our official entry into the Assembly of Nations is the crowning glory of our struggle for freedom, and our nation will find in United Nations membership an opportunity to serve our nation, and our nation will find in United Nations an opportunity to serve the cause of international peace and security. Indonesia will devote its efforts to this end, to the betterment of living conditions for all people, and to the understanding of Asia's role in world affairs.
Thank you, gentlemen. Taking part in today's University of Chicago Roundtable on Indonesia, the fourth program in a roundtable series on problems of Asia, were His Excellency Dr. Ali Sastro Amijoyo, the ambassador from Indonesia, John Embry, anthropologist of Yale University, Charles Wolfe, Jr., economist of the Far Eastern Program of the Economic Cooperation Administration, and Philip Talbot, political scientist of the University of Chicago. The printed pamphlet of today's roundtable discussion of Indonesia contains the full text of the discussion and publishes the new Indonesian Constitution in its first English translation. Be sure to write to the University of Chicago Roundtable, Chicago 37, Illinois, to secure your copy of today's pamphlet. Single copies are 10 cents in coin. A full year's subscription to the Roundtable pamphlet costs only $3. Enclose $3 with your order and make your subscription begin with today's program on Indonesia. I'll repeat the address, the University of Chicago Roundtable, Chicago 37, Illinois. Next week, the Roundtable continues its series on problems of Asia with a report on Communist China. Be sure to hear the views of experts who have just returned from living inside Communist China. And may we invite you to join the new Roundtable home study courses in human rights, world politics, and economics in the modern world. These courses are open to all. You may begin at any time, and two of them are college credit courses. Write to University of Chicago Roundtable, Chicago 37, Illinois, for the brochure describing the courses and telling how you may enroll. Each month, three 24-volume sets of the Encyclopedia Britannica are awarded to the students in the three home study courses most successfully completing the courses that month. Today's program originated from station WRC, Washington. The Roundtable is directed by George E. Pope and is a public service presentation by NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.